This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wu-Heap, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
What the European Commission is going to say is that, according to a number of sources, every country in the EU that does not accept a migrant quota will pay a charge. They're not calling it a penalty, but that is essentially what it is.
That's VOA's Luis Ramirez talking about a new proposal to deal with the migrant crisis in Europe. Details coming up.
Also, a new survey finds overwhelming support among Africans for the media. And Human Rights Watch is accusing both the Somali government and the militant group Al-Shabaab of using abusive and violent tactics to intimidate journalists.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the European Commission meets tomorrow to announce a proposal that EU countries refusing to accept their quota of refugees must pay a hefty penalty. The plan needs the approval of member states and the EU Parliament, which meets in June. EU commissioners hope the new asylum plan resolves major conflicts that threaten the stability of the 28-state union. VOA European correspondent Luis Ramirez in London talked to David Arnold in Washington about the proposal.
Well, the European Commission is set to unveil the details of a report that it has been preparing on overhauling the asylum rules of the European Union. This is a desperate attempt to deal with the migrant crisis. We've seen 1 million people coming into the European Union just over the last year. What the European Commission is going to say is that, according to a number of sources, every country in the EU that does not accept a migrant quota will pay a charge. They're not calling it a penalty, but that is essentially what it is, a sanction. And according to the estimates from sources within the European Commission, those charges could amount to about $290,000 per migrant.
What's the likelihood that a vote in the EU Parliament and among the member states that this would actually be approved?
Well, that vote will come in June, and there is some support for it. Curiously, that support is coming from countries in Eastern Europe that have not wanted to take any migrants at all, countries like Poland and Hungary. They would welcome an alternative to any mandate to accept any number of migrants, and so some have indicated that they would prefer to pay the charges than to accept the migrants. And so there is some support there. On the other hand, for countries that have welcomed the migrants, like Germany, they see this as a way of getting states that have been reluctant to somehow deal with the problem rather than have some threaten to leave the EU, which is certainly one of the discussions that's going on.
This all comes about because of the migrant crisis. What is this likely to do to the migrant flows?
The revamping of the asylum rules is part of a bigger plan to deal with the flow of migrants, which last year reached 1 million people. One of the big components of this plan to deal with the migrant flow is an agreement that the European Union reached with Turkey, in which Turkey would accept migrants deported from Greece in return for the possibility of having visa restrictions relaxed on Turkish citizens traveling to the European Union. This is something that Turkey has been after for a very long time. What this deal has done to the migrant flows is that it has significantly cut the flow of people coming in through the Aegean Sea. The latest figures from the EU say that that flow is down to 63 people per day who are intercepted making the crossing. That's down from 10,000 just a few months ago.
That is an incredible drop. But I'm wondering now if part of the deal that was negotiated, I think it was 45 days ago, with Turkey was that Turkey gets visa-free access to Europe. Is that still viable?
Well, that's a big part of the plan that is to be unveiled on Wednesday in Brussels. That is something that Turkey has been after for a very long time. It was a very big incentive for them to accept this deal to take the migrants back. And so now Turkish leaders have been pressing the EU to make good on their promise. Now, it's not without strings. Turkey, in order to get those concessions, has to meet something like 72 legal and technical conditions. Those have to do with rule of law, respect for minority rights, freedom of expression. What is interesting is that it was only a month ago that EU officials said that Turkey had only met about half of those conditions, and so it seemed like the prospect of lifting the restrictions on Turkish nationals to travel visa-free and into Europe was a very distant prospect. So this is kind of a surprise. And the way analysts are explaining it is that the Turkish government has been pressing very hard, very firmly on Europe to make good on that promise or risk losing Turkey's cooperation, taking back the migrants and dealing with a crisis.
The concern of many of the EU members has been human rights in Turkey. Are they likely to approve visa-free travel?
The mood is that Europe at this point is so desperate to find a solution to the migrant crisis, because what you have across the continent, you have the rise of right-wing movements, you have the rise of movements to break away from Europe. In Britain, that's very clear, where the British next month are due to vote on a referendum on whether to stay in the European Union or leave. And the immigration issue is a huge part of the argument. Europe is very motivated to find a solution and find one quickly. And that's what gives those who are proposing these changes to the asylum plan hope that it will pass quite easily. But it will not be without argument, and it certainly won't be without debate.
That was VOA's Luis Ramirez in London talking to David Arnold in Washington.
A new survey finds overwhelming support among Africans for the media and their role as a watchdog against government corruption and abuse. The Pan-African Research Network, Afrobarometer, has released its findings on World Press Freedom Day today, and VOA's Jody Capaway reports.
The Afrobarometer survey is based on 54,000 interviews in 36 countries during 2014 and 2015. Africans were asked whether the media should have the right to publish any views and ideas without government control. Anthony Wafula is the nonpartisan network's communications coordinator for East Africa and is based in Nairobi.
We found that a majority of Africans, 54%, think the news media should have the right to publish any views and ideas without government control. But you also find that a strong 42% say government should have the right to prevent publications it considers harmful to society. The government should have some role to play in terms of what is being published, as long as it is considered to be harmful.
But that raises the question, what is considered harmful?
Harmful is subject to various interpretations. In the past few years, some governments have been trying so hard to leverage on what the media is able to publish. So harmful here could mean anything that harms the interest of the society. Harmful could also mean things to do with probably certain aspects of moral values. Let's take the example of Uganda and the anti-gay bill, and that could be considered to be some harmful practices. Burundi could also be having its own definition of what harmful is, so it's a little bit vague.
Wafula says the survey also asked Africans whether the media should constantly investigate and report on government mistakes and corruption.
We actually established that more than two-thirds, that is 69% of Africans, say the news media should constantly investigate and report on government mistakes and corruption. And actually, this is the majority view in every surveyed country except Egypt, where 46% agree.
In addition, the Afrobarometer survey shows that 59% of Africans questioned say the news media are somewhat or very effective in revealing government mistakes and corruption. Some 32% disagree. 51% say the media rarely abuse their freedom by publishing lies, while 36% disagree. Wafula says this could be due to how they report stories and whether the stories are corroborated. Afrobarometer says that radio remains the most common news source. 7 in 10 Africans listen to radio. 47% of those who listen do so on a daily basis. But the survey says radio and newspapers are slowly losing ground, while TV and the Internet are gaining. One in five Africans regularly get their news from social media. The Internet and social media are more popular news sources than newspapers among youth and adults who have a post-secondary education. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Also on World Press Freedom Day, Human Rights Watch is accusing both the Somali government and the militant group Al-Shabaab of using abusive and violent tactics to intimidate journalists. The rights group is calling on authorities to bring an end to the attacks against journalists in the country. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Human Rights Watch published a report Tuesday titled "Like Fish in Poisonous Water," that documents killings, arbitrary arrests and threats against journalists since 2014. Letitia Beda, a Human Rights Watch researcher, says Somali journalists face daily threats in doing their work.
Over the last 2 years, we've found that journalists are facing threats, harassment and also violence from all sides. Traditionally, Al-Shabaab has obviously been one of the most dangerous actors in Somalia for journalists. Journalists now facing threat and manipulation from many different actors, which is making it incredibly difficult for them to report, even on basic news stories.
Since 2014, more than 10 journalists have been killed. Six others survive assassination attempts. One survivor is journalist Abdirizak Ilmi. In October 2014, armed men attacked him outside his house in Mogadishu. A car approached us and it stopped in front of us. They started firing at my friend and me. The first bullet hit me in the hands. When I tried to run, they hit me in the back, my stomach and around my kidney. I ran towards the house. They continued firing at me. I fainted at the door of the house. Ilmi was hospitalized for 4 months. He says he doesn't know who attacked him, but is certain they attacked because of his work. After much thought, the reason I was attacked, I realized, was because of my profession. I don't believe that there is anything that will make them attack me other than being a journalist. Much of my life and time, I worked in the media. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, most of the journalists killed in Somalia cover politics and war. Last month, the Somali government executed 3 people, including a former journalist, for their alleged involvement in the killing of 6 journalists. Human Rights Watch accuses the government of bringing charges when an act is attributed to Al-Shabaab, but failing to prosecute government officials. The organization also accuses regional authorities of intimidating journalists and closing down media stations that do not comply with unlawful orders. Over the years, many Somali journalists have fled to neighboring countries to escape the threats and intimidation. One of them is Said Hassan, a former reporter now living in Kenya. In Somalia, if you're a journalist, you're a target. Being a target, it makes you worried and fearful all the time. Some time back, they threw a grenade at us, and sometimes they threaten us in our station, he said. Are you going to wait for death? This has forced me and others to flee the country. Earlier this year, President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud signed a controversial media law that gives government officials a wide range of powers to arrest and prosecute journalists for disseminating false information. With Somali elections less than 4 months away, Human Rights Watch called on the government to allow different views and opinions to be aired and to allow safe and open reporting. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Listening to Africa News Tonight on the following frequencies.
19 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight. The use of forced anal examinations to prove homosexuality in Kenya is being challenged in Mombasa's High Court. Human Rights Watch says the exams prove nothing and are antiquated and demeaning. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
Two Kenyan men alleged they were subjected to forced anal examinations at the Mombasa Coast Provincial General Hospital in February 2015, after police took them into custody for alleged homosexual conduct. They have filed a constitutional petition against the magistrate who ordered the exams, the hospital, the police, the director of public prosecution, and the health ministry. Human Rights Watch senior researcher for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights is Neela Ghoshal.
This is the first time that we've documented the use of anal examinations in Kenya. And it's quite disturbing, I have to say, because Kenya has a reputation of having a quite liberal, cosmopolitan medical community, doctors who are very well educated, who understand what kind of procedures are scientific and what kind of procedures aren't.
The independent forensic expert group says these procedures are not scientific. It says forcibly conducted anal examinations are medically and scientifically worthless, and the practice constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and possibly torture. Human Rights Watch says these examinations prove and accomplish nothing except humiliating those who are subjected to them. The group argues that Kenya's Sexual Offenses Act, as well as international law, dictate the exams constitute sexual assault and possibly rape if they involve any form of unwanted penetration. Requests for a response went unanswered from Kenya's Ministries of Health and Gender, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution, Mombasa's Coast Provincial General Hospital, the police, and judiciary. Human Rights Watch says it has documented forced anal examinations since 2010 in Cameroon, Egypt, Lebanon, Tunisia, Turkmenistan, Uganda, Zambia, and Kenya. The Mombasa High Court is scheduled to hear the constitutional petition Wednesday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Tensions over the disputed territory of Western Sahara are heating up again. In March, Morocco expelled more than 80 UN civilian staffers after Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the situation in the territory as an occupation. Mr. Ban was referring to Morocco's 1975 annexation of the former Spanish colony. In 1991, Morocco reached a ceasefire with the Sahrawi People's Polisario Front, which wants independence. The UN mission there, known as MINURSO, was set up to monitor the ceasefire and prepare for a referendum. The vote was never taken place. Last Friday, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution giving a one-year extension to MINURSO. It calls on all parties to continue negotiations in good faith to achieve a mutually acceptable political solution. Anwar Bokars is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the situation.
This conflict escalated. I think the Secretary General meant well, but he mismanaged the whole process. The fact that he said that Morocco is occupying Western Sahara, and he said it from Algeria, which, as you know, it's a major supporter of the independentist Polisario. But Morocco's position has been clear, I think, and now it's trying to widen that support. That's why the king went to Russia, he's going to China. I think Morocco doesn't trust that the United States has publicly supported Morocco's plan to resolve the conflict, which is grant wide autonomy to the region. That's what Morocco proposed, and that's what the United States supports. But the U.S. has not thrown its lot behind it in the Security Council. But it was unfortunate, the statement from the Secretary General, and how it escalated. The Sahrawi independence movement sticks to its initial position, which is it wants independence and a referendum that leads to independence, and it's supported by Algeria. So neither of these two, unfortunately, Morocco or Algeria, Polisario wants to budge. Morocco believes that it has gone the farthest, it has offered widespread autonomy. Morocco say we have invested over $3 billion in basic infrastructure. Now there is a scheduled about $9 billion investment. Morocco has also created, as you know, an independent National Council for Human Rights. It has created regional commissions. More needs to be done. The issue, unfortunately, is that the human rights issue has been politicized. Everything is politicized. And the last thing we want is Morocco to be destabilized, or what if Western Sahara becomes independent and it turns to be a failed state? Look at what happened to South Sudan. Look at what happened to northern Mali. Look at what happened in South Algeria, for example. And this is why Western governments, especially the U.S. and the French, are very careful not to try to destabilize the status quo.
Why did Morocco refrain from allowing the long-awaited referendum to decide the fate of the Western Sahara?
Because Morocco has always insisted that, how do we know who is a Sahrawi? Who is allowed to vote? These are, mobile folks. Some of them are Sahrawis in Mauritania, others are in Morocco, others are in Algeria. So who is a Sahrawi? Morocco feels that the whole process is not just, and the Polisario sticks to its own version that only some people are allowed to vote. So this is a non-starter. And in any case, Morocco says that since a referendum cannot be held, and Moroccans are not sure that they might even win that referendum, so they believe that a political solution, as the Security Council says, only a political solution that is mutually acceptable can resolve the conflict. And for that, there has to be compromise. So it's a very complex issue. My very concern is that this cannot be a viable state that would easily be destabilized by all these violent extremists, organized criminals, or it will be a satellite state of Algeria. So we have to be very, very careful. We have to be very realistic. I believe that the prospect of an independent Western Sahara state remains unrealistic. At the same time, I believe that Morocco has to be pressured to improve human rights, to improve economic rights. And frankly, there is no solution to go ahead and implement its autonomy plan, devolve political power, economic power to local populations, because we cannot hold this hostage, you know, to what's happening in New York or to the geopolitical rivalry, unfortunately, between Morocco and Algeria. The two cannot agree on anything, very unfortunate. And it's only the Sahrawis, obviously, that have been suffering in the camps in Algeria. Miserable conditions. It's a really horrific situation, and that needs to be addressed.
Anouar Boukarz is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy.
Reports from Libya say Islamic State militant group is fortifying its positions in Sirte in anticipation of an attack by the Libyan army. The reports say the group is building sandbag barriers on the coastal road leading to the city, as well as planting landmines. The Libyan armed forces are under the command of Lieutenant General Khalifa Haftar, who once supported longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi. He returned from exile in the U.S. to take part in the 2011 uprising against him. Haftar was appointed to head the army by the then internationally recognized government in Tobruk. However, many view him as a strongman, attempting to gain power and not supporting the UN-backed government of national accord. Haftar has launched what he calls Operation Dignity against Islamists in eastern Libya. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 1730 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people. Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.